Well, tonight I pay a 40th anniversary tribute to the West End musical Beyond the Rainbow, which was an adaptation of an original Italian musical. It had music by Armando Trovajoli, and the English lyrics were by Leslie Bricus. And to introduce tonight's programme, which we shall hear from the 1978 original London cast recording, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the programme, via telephone from the south of France, the Academy, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist and screenwriter, Leslie Bricus. Good afternoon, Leslie.
Hello, Rob. Good to hear you again.
And good to hear from you too as well. Well, 1978 was a very busy year for you with three musicals premiering in the West End. But first of all, let's discuss the one that was most successful, which opened at the Adelphi Theatre on the 9th of November 1978, Beyond the Rainbow, which was the English title of the original Italian, which I'll let you pronounce again.
Well, the title was a problem. The title in Italian was Aggiungi un posto a tavola, mm-hmm. which meant bring another chair to the table. And there was also a song called that, which had an impenetrable lyric. So I had to simplify it. And I wrote a song called Come Join Us at the Table, which kind of fitted the structure of the music. But we ended up with the show being called Beyond the Rainbow because it was a Noah's Ark story. Beyond the Rainbow was a little more approachable as a title.
Indeed, yes. And interestingly enough, based on an English novel, After the Deluge, by, two gentlemen who used the pseudonym of David Forrest, but who were actually David Eliades and Robert Forrest Webb.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. And I believe they were responsible for, or at least one of them, I guess, was responsible for adapting the Italian book back into English again for the London production.
Yes, David Forrest. He was a good writer, and my main attraction to the piece was any chance to go to Rome I take. I once did an hour television show with Sophia Loren in Italy.
Ah, great.
And she sang a bunch of my songs, and we had a wonderful time. So Evie and I, my wife, we always go down there if we have a chance. And this involved staying at the lovely Hassler Hotel. And over a period of months, we went there about a dozen times and had a very good time down there.
Ah, great. And how did your original involvement come about? Was it because somebody knew you were interested in Noah's Ark?
No. It happened through an American producer called Harry Bernson, who was involved in the production. And I met him in California, and he asked if I'd like to do it. And I knew who Armando Trovajoli, the composer, was, because he did a number of very good film scores. He was married to the Italian movie star Pierangeli.
Nice.
And he was a charming, lovely man. He said of himself, "I am the Italian Henry Mancini."
Ah.
And Henry objected to that. Henry said, "I am the Italian Henry Mancini."
Indeed.
Anyway, he wrote some lovely melodies, and I enjoyed working with Armando. We used to meet in my favorite place in Italy, which is Portofino. Evie and I used to live in Portofino in the 60s, and in fact, we're going there next week from here. It's the most beautiful village on the sea in Italy, and we go back there whenever we can.
Yes. And how did you go about providing the English lyrics? Did you do a literal translation of the Italian, or did you just use the gist of the actual songs?
No, it was a combination of things. If an idea would adapt, because it's very difficult, because Italian has far more syllables in it than English. The title proved that, Aggiungi un posto a tavola. That's not an easy one to get your tongue around. So it was a pleasant and fairly easy job because Armando wrote lovely melodies, and I adapted the idea rather than the content.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Of each song.
Uh-huh.
The main problem with that show was the man playing the leading role, who was a young priest God decides that there's going to be another flood to end the world all over again. And they had a big star called Johnny Dorelli playing the lead. And the intention was, obviously, they did the show in English because they wanted to bring it to London. It was a huge hit in Italy. It had run for 3 years when I came on board.
Yes.
And they wanted to bring Johnny Dorelli to London. And nobody in London had ever heard of Johnny Dorelli, so I wasn't too optimistic that that would work. And I suggested to them that they had an English equivalent of Johnny Dorelli to play the part. But the producers of the show, who were the sort of Italian Rodgers and Hammerstein, as producers rather than composers, were two gentlemen called Garinier and Giovannini. And they said, no, John Dorelli will absolutely make a wonderful success. I approached the producer in London, who was Harold Fielding, about the possibility of Tommy Steele doing it, because he was the nearest I could get to an English equivalent of Johnny Dorelli.
Yes.
And he would have been wonderful, Tommy. And Harold Fielding had produced a lot of his shows, so it wasn't a hard sell for him. But the Italians held the whip hand, and they said, no, it's going to be Johnny Dorelli. So Johnny Dorelli didn't speak much English, which was not a great help. He sort of had Chico Marx kind of English, you know.
Yes.
So we did it in London, and he had a real problem with the language, and, of course, nobody ever knew who he was. But the show was attractive. It was a good-looking show, and it had some nice songs in it. And it ran for 8 or 9 months at the Adelphi Theatre, which was respectable.
Yes.
But it was never what it should have been. I think with Tommy, it would probably have done what it did in Italy. It would have probably run for 3 or 4 years.
Indeed.
I remember once later on saying to the producers, you know, it's a bit like putting Gina Lola Brigida into Evita. And they thought that was a good idea.
Oh.
Thank God we were spared that. But at least Gina Lola Brigida could sing. But anyway.
Indeed, yes. Well, we'll have a chance, of course, during the program to hear Johnny Dorelli. I must admit he's a pleasant enough singer, but he sounds more like a cabaret artist than a musical theatre performer.
Yes, I don't know what he was. Interestingly enough, I went back to Rome about 20 years later, and at the same theatre, which was called the Sistina Theatre, Beyond the Rainbow, or Aggiungi, that title in Italian, was running in a revival with Johnny Dorelli again, and it was still a sellout.
Ah.
So there you go.
Very, very popular in Italy, but it didn't really translate to London.
Not really, no. But it was mainly a linguistic problem. You know, he didn't have the handle on the English, and I'm amazed that the producers wanted to do it. But anyway, it was their call, and so we did it.
Indeed, yes. I suppose they were trying to establish him as a star in the English-speaking world, similar to, I'm trying to think of the other Italian actor, Walter Chiari. He appeared in quite a number of international productions and even came to Australia to appear in a couple of films.
Who was that?
Walter Chiari.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. And there was that. What was that fellow who did the final Pink Panther? He won an Oscar.
Yeah, Roberto...
He won an Oscar for a film about the Holocaust a year later.
That's all right. Yeah.
And I know, because I wrote the song for the Pink Panther that he did with Henry Mancini.
Okay.
And it didn't work. He played sort of Clouseau again, you know.
Yes, not son of.
This was after Peter Sellers died.
That's all right, yes. Mm-hmm. And interestingly also, in the London cast of Beyond the Rainbow was the English comedian Roy Kinnear, who doesn't really sing and he doesn't do a Rex Harrison. He more or less recites his songs or lyrics.
No, he was funny. He was funny in the part, Roy Kinnear. And obviously, he at least had something of a following in London. So I think he probably helped the box office. And that was really, there were no box office names apart from his in the show. And so it's amazing that they managed to keep it going for 9 months. But it played a good 9 months. You know, it was quite successful, well, enough for them to not scream at the result. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a big theatre, the Adelphi. It's a beautiful theatre. I've used several times. I've been involved in shows there.
Indeed. And after doing The Good Old Bad Old Days with Anthony Newley, in which both God and the Devil appear on stage, well, this is another musical, although this time you only had the voice of God, apparently.
Yes, it's very strange, because I'm doing an animated film at the moment of Noah's Ark.
Ah, great. Not
connected with this one, it's completely different, but it works well. And animation is a safe way to go. I'm currently very much into animation.
Yes, yes. I guess it's a good way to treat all the animals who come two by two, doing it in the computer.
Well, you can do all sorts of things. Exactly. We're doing a Scrooge, Dickens Christmas Carol, as an animated film too. And of course, you can do much more wonderful things with the ghosts and the spirits, because visually you have much greater freedom in animation. So it's rather an interesting medium to work in.
Oh, right. Are you going to utilise the stage score or the original screen score for Scrooge?
It's a combination of things. I'm using quite a lot of the original film and the stage score and some new songs. So it'll be the only thing that's worrying for me about animation is they take so long to make. You know, it's 3 or 4 years
yes.
of work, not for me, but for the animators, and it's rather frustrating to have to wait that long. But it's beautiful. The work I've seen so far is very good. Looking forward to it.
Yes, yes, and I guess you have to have the vocal cast come in to record all the songs and the dialogue before they do the actual animations.
Yes. They've got ambitious plans for it. All sorts of wonderful names they want to. Because it's a rather nice job for an actor, because it's only 3 or 4 days work to read the part.
Indeed.
Because they have to read the part before they can start animating, because they have to fit the animation to the lip movements of the actor. So the actors come first, and then the artists drawing them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very complicated process.
Yes, and interestingly, I've seen some of these behind-the-scenes documentaries with these animated films, and they don't even have the cast together in the one room. They just record each person's dialogue separately.
Oh, yes, you can take them on. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you can take a dialogue scene between two people, but do them separately. They don't have to be together, mm-hmm. though it's better if they are for the comedic timing. It's far better to have two actors in a room rather than one doing individual lines.
Exactly.
But, you know, the reason they get stars to do it is because it's a good gig for the actor. Mm. You know, 3-4 days and you've got a film role.
Indeed, yes, yes. But I guess returning to 1978, and the other featured show that we'll have time to play some music from is the Travelling Music Show, which premiered at Her Majesty's Theatre on the 28th of March, starring the one and only Bruce Forsyth, and featuring virtually the best of Newley and Bricus up to that date.
Yes, that was a sort of songbook show, and it didn't really work. The director was a man called Bert Shevelov, who was a very funny American. Actually, he was an intellectual. He was a professor at Harvard University or Yale University, and I'd worked with him. He wrote a very funny show with Stephen Sondheim called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Oh, that's right.
He wrote the book with Larry Gelbart, and he was a sort of friend of mine. He was a very funny man. He was a friend of George Axelrod, and he and I worked on a show together called Feeling No Pain in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also had a good reputation as a director, but I wasn't very happy with what happened on Travelling Music Show. So really all it was, oh, I know what it was. Uncle Bert, we called him, was brought in to make a book around the show. That's what it was, and direct it.
Yes.
He was meant to provide a book that would link and make sense of the songs, and that's what was missing. It didn't happen that way. They were just the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not well produced, but the songs kind of stood up, and Bruce being Bruce Forsyth was lovely in the show. but it didn't have the support system that it needed, really, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So it comes across well on record, but obviously not on the stage itself, unfortunately.
Yes, well, at the time, Bruce was riding high. He'd been the host of the Sunday Night at the Palladium, which was our leading vaudeville variety TV show every Sunday and had a huge following on television. So Bruce was big box office, and the show didn't suffer from that point of view because people wanted to see Bruce. Mm-hmm. But everything else, I feel, really let him down, except the songs, which he delivered beautifully.
Yes, yes. So you feel that that type of material works better as a staged concert, as with your songbook concert a few years back?
Yes, well, I think, you know, I did another songbook show recently called Pure Imagination, and the director of that, Christopher Renshaw, we decided we would just do songs. We had like 50 songs in under 2 hours, and not a word of dialogue, just going, kind of vaguely linking the content of each song to the next song. And without any other dialogue, it just worked beautifully. And I wish we had done that with the Traveling Music Show, because it had a book that needn't have been there. We'd have been far better to have no book and 10 more songs.
Yes.
Because that's what people like. They enjoy the songs. I mean, most of them go to a musical for the songs, not the book.
Yes. So the book scenes were more of a distraction from the action rather than making any valuable contribution to it.
Yes, exactly so, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, of course, the score not only combines songs by both you and Anthony Newley, but also one by Herbert Kretzmar and Anthony, and also some that you had done separately for Pickwick with Cyril Lornadel and Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yes, I can't remember specifically what the songs were, but it kind of worked out. But the songs didn't make the sense they should. I don't know, the approach to the whole book was wrong, but it survived because I think the musical material helped it to survive, and we were happy enough with that.
Yes, yes. I came across some notes which mentioned some of the antics that were used in the show. For instance, The Good Old Bad Old Days is performed by the characters of Fred and Reg as two incontinent drunks. And the song Nothing Can Stop Me Now is performed by a quivering goalkeeper. So it sounds as if it was quite a bit of a muddle.
well, because the songs from Grease Paint went straight to Broadway.
Yes.
So that was a new song in London, because Grease Paint hadn't at that time been performed in London.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And The Joker, of course, being another of the songs from that too. And the third musical you didn't have much luck with in 1978 too was Kings and Clowns, which opened in March too. Based, of course, on your long-held dream of putting King Henry VIII and his six wives on the musical stage.
Yes, unfortunately, we used Frank Finlay to play Henry VIII, and I think we were so keen to get the show on that we really miscast him, which wasn't fair to him, and it wasn't fair to the show either. At the time, and I didn't know of him until a bit later, there was an English actor who really was Henry VIII called Brian Blessed.
Oh, yes.
And Brian Blessed had a brilliant voice, and he looked exactly as I imagine Henry VIII did, and he was a larger-than-life character, and I thought, that's Henry VIII, but it was too late.
Indeed. And even Keith Michelle would have been good casting after appearing in the BBC TV series and film.
Yes, Keith. Keith did Scrooge down in Melbourne for us, as Scrooge.
That's all right.
In the 90s. We were doing a Christmas carol when it was about 110 degrees, I remember. And they paraded through Melbourne with all this Christmas doodah in, because in the middle of your summer, it didn't work.
Exactly.
Well, the show worked beautifully. He was a very good Scrooge, Keith. He was a lovely man. And in fact, in London, Newley and I wrote the show, Roar of the Grease Paint, in Keith's house in Hampstead.
Oh.
He had a house in London, And we used the house because he newly was married to Joan Collins at the time, and they rented the house while we wrote the show. And so I have fond memories of Keith.
Indeed, yes. Well, I played one of the musicals that he appeared in only the other week. Irma La Douce, of course, and he was also in the London production of Robert and Elizabeth with a fellow Australian, Jim
Broyle.
That's
right. I remember, yes, Robert and Elizabeth, indeed. Very good.
Although, interestingly, when it came to Melbourne, well, June Bronhill repeated the role of Elizabeth, but Dennis Quilley appeared as Robert Browning.
Oh, my God, how lovely, yes, Dennis Quilley. He was a lovely performer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've mentioned the cartoon versions of Noah's Ark and Scrooge that are on your plate at the moment, but how are the plans going for your other projects, the Sunday Dallas musical and also the Sammy Davis Jr. bio musical?
Yes, well, my next show is about Sammy Davis Jr. Sammy was very close to us and recorded a lot of my songs over the years, and I've written a show called Sammy. Mm-hmm. The main problem with that one was trying to find someone to play Sammy, and we opened the show in San Diego in California with someone whom Sammy actually brought to my house one evening in L.A., and he said, "This is the next me." Mm-hmm. And he was a wonderful performer with the unlikely name of Oba Bavatunde.
Ah.
And he had a lot of Sammy's style, but unfortunately, the show required for Sammy to be in his 30s because he had to play Sammy younger and older. And by the time we did the show in San Diego, he was too old for us. But we got lucky because we finally cast Sammy in the person of Giles Torreira, who is playing the lead in Hamilton, mm-hmm. the, you know, the massive hit musical.
Yes.
And he's in London, and Sammy is the next one when he comes out of Hamilton, which will be next year.
Ah, great. Uh-huh. And the other musical that you told us the plot about, Sunday Dallas, is that getting nearer to
which
the stage?
One?
Sunday Dallas, about the young lady who's an understudy in two musicals that are...
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Sunday Dallas. Again, casting is the thing. And the producers kind of want major movie stars. And I said, you're not going to get major movie stars, because major movie stars are far better off doing films than stage.
Yes.
But... there's something going on that I can't talk about, but hopefully we will have it on its feet by the end of next year.
Oh, great. Well, at the age of 87, you're showing no signs of slowing down, and I guess work keeps you busy and keeps you active and keeps the brain cells ticking over.
Well, that's it. 87 not out, as we say in cricket.
Indeed, yes. So have you got any further projects that you want to get underway?
No, I've got my plate quite full at the moment because I've got, we've got, one major project is being made into a film. Frank Wildhorn and I wrote a musical called Jekyll and Hyde.
That's all right, yes.
Which has been doing very well all over the world. We have an offer from Hollywood to make it into a movie, a major movie. And we're waiting for a screenplay. I wrote the book and lyrics, and Frank Wildhorn wrote the music. And we're awaiting a screenplay, which we shall have in October. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will be filmed next year.
Ah, great. So you're not going to tackle the screenplay yourself or collaborate with anyone on it yourself?
No, because there's a very hot young screenwriter who's got a wonderful concept for it. It will be much, much darker than the show. I mean, the show is dark enough anyway, but on screen you can do so many different things that you can't do on the stage, because on screen you have a thing called a close-up, which you can never get in the theatre.
Exactly.
So I know a little bit about what he's going to do, and it's very exciting.
And, of course, the transformation scenes are far more convincing on film than they are on
stage. Oh, yes. I mean, if you've ever seen the Spencer Tracy version,
indeed,
the transformation was a sort of lap dissolve on his face. It was quite cleverly done, but that's all the techniques you could use in so long ago. It was 1940s it was made. Strangely enough, it was made in the 30s, and... He won the Oscar. Frederick March played him and won the Oscar.
Yes.
And 9 years later, they did the film again with Spencer Tracy, and he was brilliant in it too. But it hasn't been made as a major movie for 70 years.
Mm.
It's quite extraordinary.
Indeed, yes. So it'll be quite a fillip for you and Frank when you get your version on the screen.
Yes, well, it'll be different and it'll be contemporary, and I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. And no doubt writing one or two additional songs for the screen version too.
Yes, happily we have to write some more stuff for it, which is good.
All right, which gives you another opportunity to win another Oscar for Best Original Song to add to the two you've already got.
Well, that would be nice, but let's see what happens.
Indeed. Well, you've previously spoken about the standard of music and films not being what it used to be, so there's every possibility, I guess. And
well, actually, you know, it's very interesting because unexpectedly, I think when they made the film of The Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman, nobody expected much to happen, and it turned into an enormous hit.
Mm-hmm.
As did La La Land the year before. So there's never any knowing what will happen with a film, how the public will react. But the musical seems to be making a comeback because there have been two very successful musicals in the last 2 years, which has not happened for quite a long time.
Yes, yes. It seems to go in cycles, doesn't it? I believe
it
when...
It does. Absolutely.
When sound films first came in the 1920s, apparently musicals were all the thing until the public became sick and tired of them. And then it was revived again with 42nd Street, and musicals took up again in the 30s and 40s.
Yep.
And
Well, you know, those shows like 42nd Street, just recently, An American in Paris was a huge hit in London, mm-hmm. based on the film version. And, it was a wonderful looking show. It had wonderful sets and wonderful original designs. So it doesn't have to be just the music. Other things can happen in musicals, which a form of stage genius, which, you know, anything like that can refresh a show and bring it back. The King and I marches on. All the old Rodgers and Hammerstein classics still have life in them.
Indeed. Yes, we've only just had a concert revival of Oklahoma earlier this year too, so that's still holding the stage in Australia as well.
Yes, it is extraordinary, but you know, they've got so many great songs in them that, you know, any show, instead of one song, they're not one-song shows, they're eight-song or ten-song shows, which has not happened in recent times very much.
Yes, indeed. Oh, and finally, about the concert version of the music of George Gershwin that you put all the lyrics to as an extended...
Yes, we're doing that in a small theatre in London next year. It's very interesting. You can do... It's called A Few Words with George. And I put lyrics to all Gershwin's instrumental pieces.
Yes.
The show can be done not in America because it's still copyright, mm-hmm. and the Gershwins and I couldn't work out an amicable arrangement. But it is public domain in the rest of the world. And when I did the demos of that, my clever arranger, Ian Fraser, we did the recording with two pianos. And it, funnily enough, works better with two pianos than with an orchestra, because in a way, in a vocal version, the singers are the orchestra.
Yes.
And if you have an orchestra and the singers, it's not as good as two pianos. So that's how we're planning to do it, and we'll see what happens.
Indeed, yes, and that goes back to the 1920s, I think, the concept of having two pianos playing in a Gershwin musical.
Yes, probably. I mean, you know, two pianos can be very effective, because Gershwin, who was a brilliant pianist, and a lot of his instrumental work was piano,
mm-hmm.
But it makes the voices clearer. I think when you've got as complex a musical score as you have in all An American in Paris and Rhapsody in Blue, all those things that I've adapted, I think you get greater clarity with less instrumentation. So we'll see if I'm right.
Ah, great. Well, thank you very much, Leslie, for coming online and bringing us up to date on your latest projects and also telling a bit about the background behind Beyond the Rainbow and the Travelling Music Show that we shall hear on tonight's programme. And we wish you every success with your future projects, and hopefully it won't be too long before some of your stage shows or even films are seen in again in Australia.
Oh, that would be very nice. Lovely to talk to you, Rob. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Leslie, and all the best to Evie and you, and bye for now.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with the Academy, Grammy and Ivor Novello Award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist and screenwriter, Leslie Brickus. Well, let's pause now on the programme for some community service and sponsorship announcements before returning with tonight's presentation of Beyond the Rainbow from the original 1978 London stage production. You're listening to 96.5 Inner FM.